The torch I carry is handsome. It's worth its heartache in ransom. And when the twilight steals, I know how the lady in the harbor feels.
It's been a long, cold winter here in New York, but Patti LuPone is sure to heat things up next week when she opens a two-week engagement of her concert show, Lady with the Torch, at the Supper Club 54 Below, performing classic torch songs by Cole Porter, George and Ira Gershwin, Harold Arlen, and other masters of the genre. She'll also be starring in a one-night reading of Tennessee Williams' The Rose Tattoo later in the month, and then she will go on to a new Douglas Carter Bean play called Shows for Days at Lincoln Center Theater. Lady with the Torch runs from the 2nd of next month to the 14th at 54 Below at West 54th Street. I'm delighted that the very busy two-time Tony Award winner Patti LuPone has found a little time to come back to our show to tell us about it.
Thank you, Leonard.
Lady with the Torch is a show you've been performing for a few years now.
Mm-hmm.
You did it at Carnegie Hall?
No, we did Faraway Places a couple of years ago. Last year at Carnegie Hall, and I think coulda, woulda, shoulda, but maybe we did. I can't remember. Who can remember anything anymore?
Well, I'm sure I'm wrong, but, you know, who can trust the internet? Anyway, but I was just wondering about the difference in doing something like this in a big space like Carnegie Hall as opposed to an intimate supper club.
Well, I have enormous training with the acting company, John Houseman's acting company, going from large stages to small stages.
You were one of the original members.
I was. And you develop a technique to know how to project in a large space and project in a small space.
It's not just projecting. You're looking into the eyes of the people who are sitting at the tables right in front of you.
Well, that I learned at the old Les Mouches. I was doing Evita, I'd go down to Les Mouches Saturday nights. And I learned more about performing in Broadway musicals doing cabaret than I learned on stage doing musicals or at my 4 years at Juilliard.
Well, how does that work, Pat?
You have to be fearless. And you have to walk on the stage and you really have to look at the people in the eyes. But I'm one of those actors that stands backstage at the top of a show and looks at the audience. They can't see me. Sometimes they catch me, but they don't normally can't see me looking at them because I want to know who I'm playing to. But you have the fourth wall in plays and in musicals, and you don't have that fourth wall in cabaret situations.
The audiences have changed over the years. You're more likely to have somebody's cell phone go off, as you've experienced in Gypsy. And I'm assuming that happens in the clubs as well. In the club, you can stop and say, will you turn that thing off?
Or you don't, because it's not, you're trying to create a mood always. But I find that in theater, actors work so hard to create an atmosphere that can be shattered in a split second. And it disturbs not just the actors, but the entire audience. And that is more disruptive than a cabaret environment.
How much does the audience change from night to night? And do you adjust your show depending on the reaction you're getting?
No, I don't think I don't. I don't know what other actors or singers do. I don't adjust my show. Let's talk about Broadway musicals. I play the show that's been directed. One hopes that your audience will, if they're restless at the top of the show or if they're bored or if they're whatever, you hope that you will be able to focus them through your technique and through the playing of the play. I don't adjust my performance. I try to get the audience to come with me.
In this show, how did you choose the songs? Are they favorite songs that you've said that you've always wanted to perform? Do you have a list?
Well, my director, Scott Whitman, and my late, great musical director, Dick Gallagher, and I got together and listened to material. And usually the way I choose stuff is I want to sing it because I'm somehow emotionally invested in the music. Is the story interesting? And usually the best songs, the lyrics and the melody are married. So
But in this case, it's all tort songs. Mm-hmm.
Well, I wanted to do bluegrass, and Scott wanted me to do torch, and he won. I'm still doing that bluegrass show eventually.
Really? You want to do bluegrass?
It's the happiest music ever. I love strings, and I love the banjo, and I love the mandolin, and I've always wanted to. I just find it extremely happy music.
And this is not happy music. In fact, you said that torch is short for torture, although I always thought it was from the phrase carrying a torch for someone. In either case, there's a lot of pain.
Pardon me. Yes, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do bluegrass. But these songs are spectacular. And
such as?
Something Cool. Body and Soul. The Man I Love.
My Life, A Wreck You're Making.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the lyrics are spectacular. And we have a five-piece or a six-piece band. I can't count. And they're all musicians. Red Press is the contractor. And these are all musicians that know this music inside and out. Mm. And I'm really, really honored to be on stage with them.
And, of course, you can get them right here in New York, where if you did bluegrass, you'd have to go somewhere else.
No, I think you can get the. Well, you might have to. You're absolutely right. But I think that we have such good musicians in New York City, you'd be able to find them. But, you know, bluegrass may be just a pipe dream. I do listen to it, and I love it. I love listening to bluegrass.
Your shows at 54 Below have become something of a regular gig. Weren't you the first performer to appear there?
Yes, I opened the club. Richard Frankel and Tom Vertel and Steve Baruch were producers on Sweeney Todd and Gypsy. And I adore them. And when Richard said that he was opening a club and wanted me to be the opening act, I was honored that they asked me, and I would do anything for them. And then it's interesting because in the old days of Broadway musicals, Ethel Merman, Mary Martin, they would finish their musical and then they would go to the Rainbow Room or they would go to the 21 Club or something and do a set. And we don't have that anymore, really. We don't have an after show life for some reason. And this is, and the other thing, it's the great thing is it's in the theater district. So,
well, we don't have cabaret the way we did in the past.
No.
But last year, Stephen Holden, New York Times, wrote that you've emerged as the godmother of what's called alt cabaret.
Yay.
What do you think? First of all, did you realize, did you know that you were the leader of a new movement?
No, I didn't. And I don't know. I wish I knew.
How would you define what alt cabaret is?
I wish I knew what that meant. I don't know what that means, and I don't know what alt cabaret is. Maybe it's not doing traditional cabaret, but then I don't really know what traditional cabaret is.
Well, how tightly scripted is the show?
Very. Mm-hmm. It's a concert. I don't know what cabaret is. I don't know what differentiates cabaret from concerts. And I prefer to think of the shows that I do as theater experiences because there is an arc. I'm telling a story. So I don't really know what cabaret is.
My guest is Patti LuPone. Another of your concert shows was called Coulda, Woulda, Shoulda, Played That Part.
Mm-hmm.
Did that give you a chance to perform songs from Broadway musicals that you would have liked to have performed in, but you didn't get a chance to?
Yes. And as a matter of fact, we just did a show in Morristown, New Jersey, and I said to my musical director now, Joseph Thalkin, we had to come up with more songs. I mean, there's just a plethora of songs, and we came up with a list of about 15 new songs to put into Coulda, Woulda, Shoulda. When I was a kid, the thing that I listened to, besides rock and roll, were... my dad listened to jazz, my mom listened to opera, and I listened to rock and roll. But my mom used to buy these albums instead of rags at the checkout. There would be albums.
Mm-hmm.
Ed Sullivan Presents Kiss Me, Kate. Ed Sullivan Presents Oklahoma. And some of the original Broadway cast would be members of these recordings. But that's how I heard the Broadway musicals, and I always gravitated to the second banana. Mm-hmm. Adelaide in Guys and Dolls, Ado Annie in Oklahoma, or the male parts, because they were just more interesting than the insipid leading lady. And so we've just come up with a list of putting in I Can't Say No, 100 Ways. Well, that's not that, 100 Ways to Lose a Man is the leading lady, but it's a different leading lady than you know, Marion the Librarian. So these are songs that I did sing, songs I wished I would have been in musicals so that I could have sung, and songs that I thought I should have sung.
Well, you were the leading lady in Evita.
I do Don't Cry for Me, Argentina.
Uh-huh. Is there ever a time when you think, if I have to sing that song one more time?
No, because audiences expect that song, and they also now expect Gypsy, and they also expect Metalark. It's nice to have signature songs. And the thing I try to get an audience to do is to allow me to introduce them to new music. Not necessarily music that's just written, but music that isn't my normal repertoire from Broadway musicals.
What about the songs that other people sang in Evita or Gypsy or Sweeney Todd or Anything Goes?
Well, I do sing Not While I'm Around from Sweeney, which is Tobias's song.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't actually thought about it. I used to sing when I was a kid. I used to do All I Need Is the Girl, because it was a really terrific song to try to figure out. I would be in my brother's room, because that's where the record player was, choreographing All I Need Is the Girl, choreographing Swing from Wonderful Town.
When you were listening to rock and roll, were you also thinking about the way the girl singers performed?
Yes, and that developed really, really bad vocal habits. I tried to get Dionne Warwick's notes any way I could, and I got into really, really bad habits. And it took Evita and beyond to break the bad singing habits. If I hadn't broken them, I don't think I'd have a voice.
I remember talking to a very well-known classical pianist who grew up in California. He said, the Beach Boys were as much of an influence on me as any of the great pianists.
That's great.
And he says if you really know what to listen to, you can hear it reflected in his work.
Wow. That's.
But have you ever thought about that, or did you just make the complete break?
Well, I knew that I wouldn't be a rock and roll singer, because I knew very early on in my life, when I was in the digits, single digits, that I had a big Broadway voice. But I gravitated to rock and roll, because why wouldn't I? I was a kid.
Of course, you wind up being an oldie singer if you
yeah,
become a rock
music
and roll star, whereas you could just keep on taking on new roles. You can become Mama Rose, and as far as I'm concerned, the best Mama Rose I've ever seen.
Oh, thank you very much, Leonard. But, you know, you're right. With rock and roll, my period was the 70s, 60s and 70s. Actually, late 50s through 70s.
But was it easy to walk on by? Sorry about that.
But those, you know, I just, my band was the band. Mm-hmm. That was my favorite band. That is my favorite band of all time.
You've done two other shows at 54 Below called Faraway Places, Parts 1 and 2. What mm-hmm. kind of songs do they include?
Well, I wanted to do an evening of just Vile, Kurt Vile. I never understood why I was not in a Bertolt Brecht Kurt Vile musical when I was a kid. I just thought that I was a perfect fit for their temperament. And I saw Happy End go by, Meryl played that role, and I saw Three Penny Opera, Ellen Green played that part, and the only time that it manifested itself was with the Los Angeles Opera, where I was cast as Leocadia Begbick in Mahagoni, mm-hmm. The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni. And I just wanted to do an evening of Vile music. I wanted to actually trace the escape from the Nazis into Paris, from Paris to New York.
Well, there really are two Kurt Viles. There's mm-hmm. the Kurt Vile who composed with Bertolt Brecht, and those are kind of art songs. And then there
and
are the gorgeous
political
songs like My Ship or
from but there's also the Paris Cabaret songs when he collaborated with different lyricists that are beautiful and deeply felt. But Scott felt that it would be too much, too heavy for the audience. And so we took the nucleus or the genesis of a Vile show, and he expanded it. And we came up with the idea of a travelogue, because most of my life is spent on the road.
And what happens when you're performing in Oklahoma City or Omaha? Do audiences respond very differently?
No, I don't think audiences are different anywhere in the world. If you reach out to them, And if you do your job, and that means come across the footlights, out to the audience and bring them to the stage, they are then, audiences walk into a theater for the same reason, and you have to answer to that reason. You have to answer that. And if you do, audiences will respond the same way. That's been my experience. I'm not saying I'm the greatest performer in the world, but if they've come to see me and I reach out to them, they come back.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you were one of the original members of John Houseman's the acting company, and we'll talk about the Rose Tattoo in connection to that in just a moment. But I was wondering about your dual career, because when I hear your name, I think of a singer who acts. But then you've appeared in a number of dramas like Masterclass, and also in slapstick comedy like Noises Off. Do you prefer to take new challenges? Did the acting, was the acting the real serious part of your training?
Yes. Well, it was the only part of my training, really. I grew up on Long Island, steeped in music at home and at school, because the Northport school system had an extremely strong music department. It still does. And I knew I could sing, and I knew I belonged on the stage in the single digits. When I was a kid, when I auditioned for Juilliard, I fell out of love with musical theater and in love with classical theater, and studied acting, only acting, for 13 hours a day, 6 days a week. So then I spent the additional 4 years with the acting company. But I knew, I mean, like most of us, David Ogden Stiers left the acting company and landed in the Magic Show. Mandy left Juilliard and ended it up in Evita. Kevin Klein, same thing. A lot of us left Juilliard and somehow ended up in musicals. I knew that's where I was going to be, but I didn't want that to be the sole focus of my career. And what happened was, the people that remembered me from the road in the acting company cast me in the plays, and the people that saw Evita cast me in the musicals. I mean, I went from Oliver into Accidental Death of an Anarchist, because Doug Weger knew me from the acting company.
You've been abroad a number of times talking about that. Aren't you going to be appearing in a new show called Penny Dreadful on Showtime?
I am. I'm
Victorian London?
Yes, I'm very proud of that. I'm very proud of that. That's an incredible series on Showtime, starring the amazing Ava Green as Vanessa Ives, and written by John Logan. And it's an impressive piece of writing and beautifully shot and extremely well acted, and it's just a really interesting story that he has created in Victorian London.
You like doing TV? You've been at 30 Rock. You've been on Girls, American Horror Show.
I do like doing TV.
But we mentioned at the beginning that on mm-hmm. April 27th, you'll be doing a stage reading of Tennessee Williams' The Rose Tattoo for just one night?
Yes, with Bobby Cannavale as Alvaro Montecavallo and members of the acting company that are Italian. Directed by Doug Hughes. This is a benefit for the acting company, and it's at the Biltmore. Well, excuse me, the Friedman. I call all the theaters by their original names, at least the original names that I grew up with.
The Friedman on 47th Street?
Yeah, wherever the Biltmore was, is. Yeah. So 47th Street. And it's a reading, and Doug Hughes is directing, as I said, and Bobby Cannavale is Alvaro. And it's really exciting. It's a fantastic play.
Can you imagine doing a fully staged version?
I'd love to. I would love to.
It's one of the plays of Tennessee Williams that doesn't get performed as much. It won the Tony for Best Play in 1951. I will always associate Anna Magnani with it. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a heavy person to follow.
Well, someone once told me when I was 26 years old doing The Baker's Wife that I look like Anna Magnani on a bad day. Well, it is hard shoes to follow.
She could not sing. I'm sorry.
No,
Patty.
She couldn't. But boy, could she act. Boy, could she act. That's one thing, you know, as I read it, and I'm reading it every day because I want to be prepared enough so that I don't have my nose buried in the book. It's so deeply felt emotionally, and yet everything is right on the surface, as is most Italian temperament. And it's the thing that I have to really harness, how deep it goes, but how quicksilver the changes you know, the transition in the mind and in the heart.
And you feel that Tennessee Williams captured that, even though he was definitely Southern and not Italian?
I think he did, yeah. And Bobby is going to be brilliant, so I'm really excited about this. He's a great actor.
You'll be going to rehearsals for the new Douglas Carter Bean play, Shows for Days, which is scheduled to open in Lincoln Center Theater in June. What can you tell us about that?
It's Douglas Carter Bean's autobiography of how he basically became a playwright. And he was born in Wyomissing, Pennsylvania, which I guess is a suburb of Reading, Pennsylvania. And he just followed his instincts, followed the star, and ended up in a storefront, which happened to be the space for a community theater.
So this is a homage, or an homage, however you want to say it, to community theater?
To the people that molded him and influenced him. And Michael Urie and Dale Sewells is in it, and directed by Jerry Zaks. Mm. So Jerry and I are being reunited after how many years since Anything Goes? We're in the Mitzi, as opposed to Vivian Beaumont, but I'm really, really excited to be doing a play.
But you won't be singing here.
No, I will be. I'll be acting.
Well, when I think of some of the people who you were in the acting company with, you mentioned Kevin Kline, Mandy Patinkin, who really showed off his acting chops on Homeland,
one
of the most brilliant
performances.
And who else was in that?
Well, in the years that I was in the acting company, David Ogden Stiers, who went on to do MASH after he did musicals. Mm-hmm. David Schramm, who went off to do Wings after he didn't do musicals. Yes, he did. He's done some musicals. It's interesting how classical actors then get thrown into musicals. Benjamin Hendrickson, who was on a soap opera for many years. Jerry Gutierrez, who became a director. I'm trying to think in my 4 years who I'm leaving out that became famous.
Still very impressive.
And it was quite a training ground for a young actor.
You have to keep all of this stuff straight. You're doing a number of different things all at the same time.
Yes. And I'm at that age where... Need I say more?
Not to me, anyway.
Oh, boy.
Patti LuPone will be performing Lady with the Torch at the Supper Club 54 Below on West 54th Street. She will be doing a one-night reading only, unfortunately, of Tennessee Williams' The Rose Tattoo later in this month. Where is that going to be?
At the Friedman on West 47th.
Oh, right. And then coming up later in the summertime, a new play. Anything else?
Penny Dreadful. Penny Dreadful, season 2, episode 3.
Thanks so much for being on our show again.
Thank you, Leonard, for having me.
Call again, for I must have you or no one. And so I'm through with love.